I strongly believe in not waiting too long before you start. Like, don't wait till you feel ready. You know, start before you feel ready, because you'll never truly feel ready. So there's a bit of that to it. But ultimately, I figured if I could make something that would interest somebody like me, then I would get people listening to it or watching it.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the Soloist Life Podcast, formerly known as Soloist Women, where we're all about turning your expertise into wealth and impact. I'm Rochelle Moulton, and today I'm here with my pal, Alistair McDermott, who helps experts to become known as the recognized authority in your field so you can command premium fees, work less hours, and never have to suffer a bad fit client again. Now, he hosts the Recognized Authority podcast, and he's written a number of practical guides to building authority, including 33 Ways Not to Screw Up Your Business podcast, which, by the way, I'm proud to have written the foreword for. And he is currently working on his next book, Recognized: How to Win and Retain High-Ticket Clients by Becoming the Prominent Authority in Your Field. Love that title. Alistair, welcome.
Well, Rochelle, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's great to be chatting with you again.
Yes, I'm so excited. It's been a while. It's been a while since we've talked. So one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on the show is to talk about, well, a little bit about how you're birthing your newest podcast. But what folks may not realize is that you went from no podcast in, I think, 2021 to, once this newest gets off the ground, I started to say five, but then we talked in the green room, maybe it's seven. You have a lot of audio options. So let's start there. I mean, when did you start your first podcast?
Well, I first started planning it in July of 2014. And this goes back to the kind of the origin story of all of this. Back in July of 2014, I went quite a long way down the route of planning a podcast, to the point of having written intro scripts, outro scripts, and having hired a voiceover artist to record the audio for those. I had this fairly far down the road of planning. And then I realized that I had a business problem, in that I wasn't niched down enough, and that the podcast that I was planning was going to be garbage because it was going to be so bland, because it was going to be trying to address everybody. Mm. So I realized then that I had a business problem, that I wasn't niched down enough. And I needed to specialize. And so that took me down the rabbit hole of doing that, which probably took me another 6 years or so to execute. And so I finally started planning in earnest in 2020 and launched in 2021. So I think I have a Guinness World Record for 7 years, or nearly 7 years, to launch a podcast.
Well, and when you say that it took you that long to niche down, is it really that you were experimenting and trying to make sure that you had a viable business model? Was that like the 6 years, how you spent that?
Yeah, that was a lot of it. So I hate to admit this, but it took me 2 or 3 years to mm-hmm. fully comprehend what the problem really was. And then once I understood that, it took me another probably 3 years to execute on it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fears associated with niching down. I talk about this on one of my podcasts, the specialization podcast. And there's a lot of fears that hold you back from doing it, being afraid of picking the wrong thing, you know. And so I didn't do it for a long time. And then I said, okay, I got to do this, you know. So I eventually did. But yeah, I wish that I'd been able to execute that a bit quicker.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that it's really hard to do for yourself. It takes what it takes sometimes. You know, sometimes we can get lucky and find the right person to help us along the path, but it does take a while. For the record, I think you were really smart to wait until you figured out kind of who you wanted to be before you poured all the energy into this podcast. But so, once you decided you were going to do it, like, what was your strategy for the podcast? How did you see it adding to your authority and growing your business?
Well, my initial strategy was, I like podcasts and I want to create a podcast. And that was about as far as it went.
I like it and I'm going to do it.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. It was, I like this topic. I would like to talk to people about this topic, and I want to make it for people like me. That's kind of what I wanted to do. And that's a fairly basic strategy, but it was good enough to get started. And I strongly believe, ironically, I strongly believe in not waiting too long before you start. Like, don't wait till you feel ready, you know, start before you feel ready, because you'll never truly feel ready. Yeah, so there's a bit of that to it. But ultimately, I figured if I could make something that would interest somebody like me, then I would get people listening to it or watching it.
Okay. That makes sense to me. So I just want to reiterate, you know, start before you're ready, because it does feel like a big leap. And then after a while, you're like, what did I wait for? This is way easier than I thought. So walk us through how you actually got that first podcast off the ground. Because I remember that's around the time that I met you, because I think you'd asked me to guest on that one, if I remember rightly. So how did you get there? How did you get it off the ground?
Yeah, that's right. You and Jonathan were some of the first guests I brought on. So I have been listening to a lot of podcasts, and I think that actually helps. I think the people who listen to a lot of podcasts make for good podcasters naturally, because we know what we like to listen to. So I think that helped a lot. I had some pretty strong ideas about what I wanted to do and didn't want to do. So I laid out a plan for the first, I think, 15 or 20 episodes. And I created a pretty full FAQ page for guests, and planning that out actually helped me to, I try to figure out what are all of the questions that a guest might have for me about the podcast. And that allowed me to plan the podcast. I didn't have a lot of external resources, but I think that I had listened to so many podcasts at that point that I knew roughly what I was doing. And then I created a spreadsheet, because I use spreadsheets for everything. And I have a planning spreadsheet that has tons of stuff in there. I created like a workflow, what the workflow of recording and editing might look like. And I put in a bunch of guests who I would want to have on. And then I started reaching out to them, like you and Jonathan. So I asked Jonathan for an introduction to you, for example, because I had worked with him as a coach.
That's right. I remember that now.
So, and in fact, now that I say that, I had a coaching call with him specifically about planning a podcast. So he was one of those people who I talked to. I also spoke with some other folks who are podcast experts, and I just did coaching calls. One of the great things about, there's a lot of coaches out there where you can just do a one-off call with them, pay for an hour of their time and, you know, soak in their expertise. And I did that with, I think, two or three different people. So that probably helped a lot. I did have a lot of the planning done, and it was more about getting their feedback on the plan that I had in place and just kind of shaping it up a bit. But that really helped.
Well, and of course, one of the questions that non-techies always ask is, you know, how am I going to get this edited? Did you, when you first started, did you do it yourself or did you outsource it immediately?
So at the very start, I did it myself. And I had enough skills to do that. It's not something I'd really recommend to people because I think that it's not a good use of your time. If you're an expert, if you're a business leader, your time is probably more valuable than you shouldn't really be doing the editing. And then later on, for season two of the podcast, season one of the podcast was the first 100 episodes. Season two was from 100 on. I decided to go to a live stream model. So where I do all of the interviews live and I don't do any editing. So I kind of took the editing step out of the workflow altogether. But I did that for a different reason. The reason I did that was because I was procrastinating about doing video, because I recorded loads of video. I had videos from almost every interview I've done, but I wasn't publishing it. And I realized that I was missing a trick because I didn't have the video. I wasn't able to do all the social media clips that you see people doing. And not having video, I think, so I said, okay, how do I do the video? Well, I'm procrastinating about this. So if I do the interviews live and everybody knows it's being live streamed, so there's no editing, it is what it is, then I just remove that editing step altogether. So that was how I did that later. But that was only after I'd done a lot. So I think I had that confidence from earlier.
But what I love about your solution is, okay, I've got this block. I know I'm not going to get over this easily, so I'm going to pivot and I'm just going to publish them live.
Yeah.
I love it. In fact, I remember now somebody in my circle that I'd introduced you to was recording on your show and she didn't know it was going to be live streamed. It was really funny. She loved it though. She absolutely loved it. So I think it's a great solution.
Yeah, and she didn't read the FAQ page because I had to.
Probably, yeah, probably. That's right.
Like I have the recording, the live recording, I have that process down after doing it so many times. Like the Recognized Authority is at episode 163, and then there's all of the other episodes. So I've done this quite a bit now at this point. But you can, on a live stream, you can actually do all of the things that you can do when you're editing a podcast. So I have a cold open now where it's a cold open on the live stream, and then I play the intro. And then I introduce the guest and then I have the guest join me. And I can replicate all of that on a live stream now. So it gives a very similar experience that if it was actually edited.
Well, I also am just, you know, interpreting from what you're saying is that you've got a process that you follow. I'm imagining since you're a spreadsheet guy, you have a checklist.
I'm like Jonathan, I'm a former software engineer, so I'm very process driven. Yes. So I have workflows and, you know, like I have a documented workflow.
Yes.
And I have SOPs. I also have a full-time assistant. She's been working with me for 3 years now. So that helps as well. It means that I'm not doing a lot of the grunt work. I'm able to hand off a lot of that stuff as well, which really helps with, you know, with the publishing of the episodes and things like that. Yeah, I think having a solid workflow, figuring it out. I mean, you don't have that at the start. You have to experiment a little bit and figure out what works for you, what doesn't work for you. That's where I think it goes back to start before you're ready, because you will have to make mistakes and figure things out as you go. And if you wait until you feel ready, you're still probably going to go through that learning process anyway. So you might as well just get started with that now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the kind of SOP that I wrote for the first few episodes, I think I changed probably 25% of it after maybe 5 episodes. And I'm still tweaking it. You know, it just takes a while to get into this sort of dance of doing it where it's comfortable. So, Alistair, how long did it take you to get traction? And by traction, I mean, you know, building a listener base, getting people to review you, getting the guests that you wanted. Like, do you remember how long that kind of took you?
I'd say it took, to get traction to the point where I was happy with it, I'd say it took me about 30 episodes, 40 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, like I was able to bring on some pretty high profile people in my world. Like I was able to get Alan Weiss to come on, for example, David C. Baker, Chris Doe, people like that. So I was able, like, for example, I put this in the book, I was able to invite Chris Doe on by saying, hey, Chris, you know, do you know what you don't have in common with Alan Weiss, David C. Baker, Ron Baker, and all these other people? I said, you haven't been on my podcast yet. And he replied in you know, 5 minutes and said, sure, let me book in. And that was because it's because when you start to get some people on, you can then name drop those people to get the next people on and kind of hopscotch your way up the food chain, as it were. So and you get higher and higher profile people. So yeah, really, I've had Bob Berg on, people like that. And by the way, those super high profile people don't necessarily get the most podcast listens or downloads or even share it sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that aspect of it. It's not just about getting high profile people to access their audience. Sometimes it's the smaller people who don't have as big an audience, but who want to help share the episode as much as possible because they're not doing a podcast interview every week, you know?
Oh, exactly. I've seen that in both of our podcasts. There's certain ones where it's incredible, the traction you can get. And then the ones with this big name, you think everybody's going to be listening. And it's kind of like, and they didn't share it with their audience because they do so many. It's always interesting to look at the stats afterwards. Maybe the most important question I should ask you is, what kind of success did you see from podcast one that made you stop and say, yep, I'm going to do a second one?
Well, I started getting inbound leads from it.
Mm.
It wasn't specifically the success that made me do the second podcast. So the second podcast that I did is called the Specialization Podcast. And the reason why I created that was because I realized that as I was doing one-to-one coaching with people who wanted to build authority, in my framework, I see that people go from being a novice to being an invisible expert who are really good at what they do, but nobody knows who they are. And then they go through the specialization step and they become a specialist. And then they start to publish and become recognized as the expert that they are. So that's kind of the framework, the basic framework or overview. And what I realized was that people who had the problem of being an invisible expert, who were still a generalist and hadn't niched down, the step that they needed to go through was the specialization step. But I realized that they didn't always make for a best fit client for me. So I wanted to create a resource that would help people do that so that when they finished that step, they were then ready to work with me on the next step of the equation, which is starting to publish and create content in some way. So I wanted to create something evergreen, kind of fire and forget. And I heard Seth Godin, and I listened to a podcast of his called Startup School that he created in December of 2010. And he published in December 2010, January 2011. And I think there was 10 or 12 episodes of that. And it was a workshop that he recorded over a weekend, and they edited and put it up online. And they never touched it since. And that podcast is out there generating leads for Seth Godin, selling his books and doing all of those other things. And he has never gone back and touched it. And I realized, okay, well, if he can do it, I can do something like that. So I decided to make one called the Specialization Podcast, just to, in part, to associate my name with the concept of specialization and niching down, to take a little bit of ownership of that concept, so that if somebody introduces me, for example, you introduce me on the podcast, you can say, Alistair is the host of the Specialization Podcast. People will think, okay, he knows something about that topic. So there's that kind of association. So I created that as to solve a problem of, these people are not quite the right fit for me, but if they solve this problem, then they become the right fit for me. So I wanted to create a resource for that. Does that answer the question?
Yeah. And that's fascinating to me because, you know, a lot of, if we were in big corporate America, we'd talk about like the customer journey. Like what you've just described is your client journey. And so you could choose just to completely ignore that piece, or you could choose to create a low cost way to teach them, whether that's a podcast, a book, some kind of a resource. So I think it was really smart of you to see where that empty piece is and be able to fill it with something that's evergreen.
Yeah. And for me, the evergreen piece is really important. Everything I do in terms of content creation, I always try and make it evergreen. Even the latest podcast called The AI Powered Thought Leader, I'm trying to make it, even though it's addressing AI, I'm still trying to make it as evergreen as possible. And if you do that, it means you can always republish and reuse and repurpose your content and send people to it years later.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about how you see all the podcasts really that you do helping to scale your business. And you know, you've talked about that a little bit. So obviously you're building a pipeline of future clients and buyers. Is it allowing you to uptick your prices or dramatically change what you offer? Like, how do you see the podcast helping?
Yeah, so it's a bit meta, but it's doing what I espouse, which is building a body of work. So the way I think of this, I think of the body of work that you create as an expert, as a thought leader, as an authority in your field. I think of that as being this kind of like almost like physical object that's built up like a like of all these different bricks. And like every time you do an interview, so I'm doing this interview with you. Every time you write a blog post, every time you do your own podcast, anytime you do a YouTube video, you're adding just a little bit more to the kind of the edifice. You're creating this surface area for people to come across you. So you're increasing your surface area for look, apart from anything else, you know, apart from things like SEO benefit and things like that. So you're creating more for people to stumble across and find you and opt into your world and say, hey, I want to listen to that person. So the more content that you create on that specialist area for that same audience, and so they come across that and then they opt in some way. And that could be following you on LinkedIn. It could be joining your email list. It could be subscribing to your podcast. And then they start to follow along. They get in your email list eventually. And then they hit reply on one of your emails and say, you know what? I'd like to get your help with this. That's the way I see it working. I think I kind of lost track of the question there, so I'm not sure if I answered you.
Well, yeah, I think you did, because really what it is, it's how do you monetize? And what I loved about your answer is that it wasn't, I sell 5 ads per episode at $1,000 a piece, because I think a lot of people think that you have to monetize your podcast in and of itself, like that it should be a standalone monetizable thing. And in fact, when you're dealing in authority, you're dealing in expertise, it's all part of your master plan. And so thank you for laying it out like that. Love it.
I guess, and maybe, you know, I think this is a philosophy of business thing, but I think that maybe I'm not mercenary enough in some ways, because I'm thinking, okay, I think that it is naive to think if I build it, they will come, because that's not quite how it works. But if you're a bit more strategic about making content for the right audience and addressing the same pain points, there is an element of that, that you do start to develop this audience over time, people who are interested in what you have to say. And in fact, this is where it comes into the AI thing. I think it's going to be more important to do that in the future, because at some point, that whole AI train is going to come into the station where we're going to be in real trouble if we don't have a personal brand.
Well, you led me perfectly into where I wanted to go next. So talk about what's behind your newest podcast launch, which is the AI-powered thought leader. And I just have to call you out on this, because I was so impressed with your speed. You sent me a LinkedIn message, I think it was over a weekend, asking for a reaction. And then inside a week, I saw your profile updated with the name of the new podcast. And you'd already recorded, I think, 3 episodes.
Yeah.
You are fast, Alistair.
Yeah, so I'll tell you, I cheated a little bit. One of those episodes is actually repurposed from the Recognized Authority. It's an episode that I debated some of this stuff with a friend of mine, Joe Casabona. But it was 100% pertinent to what we're talking about there. Yeah, so I do believe in moving fast. I think that there's an accelerating effect to moving fast, which is, I think, a tautology. But there is something about moving fast that makes a difference. And I think I just wanted to do something on this topic. Mm-hmm. Actually, the irony is I was thinking about doing this about 6 to 9 months ago, and I couldn't quite find the angle on it that I wanted to do. I didn't want to be just a bland, here's somebody else talking about AI, like, you know, people talking about Bitcoin or people talking about social media, kind of jumping on the bandwagon. But I did want to discuss, and I think it's important to talk about it. I had to find the angle. I finally got that last week. I just realized, okay, I want to talk about this conflict, this inherent contradiction in AI and thought leadership and using AI to create thought leadership content in particular. I thought that was a really interesting subject area to have some interesting conversations with people. So that's why I decided to start it. And then the other thing that this is a bit meta as well. One of the reasons I was able to do all of this so quickly is because I used AI. This is a video podcast, and there's a video introduction if you watch it. And everything in that video introduction was AI generated, from the voiceover to the music to the video, the different video scenes that you see in the background. And I kind of felt like I didn't have permission to use AI to do that for my other podcast. But specifically because this is on the topic of AI, I thought it would be, I kind of feel like I have inherent permission to do that, which is maybe worth thinking about as well, because that kind of feeds in, this is very meta, but that feeds into the idea of, you know, can we use AI to create thought leadership content? And so I'm just fascinated by this whole area. I think it's really interesting.
Well, especially because there's a lot of emotion around it right now. There are people who don't want to hear about it at all. There are people who think it changes everything. There are people who get mad about it. So I kind of like that diving in, and I can see the connection back to your authority work. So, it, you know, on the surface, it makes sense. I like the strategy behind it. And frankly, I can't wait to listen to this.
Well, let me tell you a little bit more about the connection then. So I rebranded, you pointed this out before we got recording. My show for the first 20 episodes, The Recognized Authority, was called Marketing for Consultants. And that's really an engineer does branding. So Marketing for Consultants, because I knew I wanted to do marketing and my target market was consultants, and I hadn't really figured out the brand. So I just slapped that on the front and said, okay, I'm just going to start. So I got to episode 20. By that point, I had realized this is the kind of the brand that I want to go for. So I decided to call it The Recognized Authority, because I'm all about the authority part, but the recognition, being recognized by other people. Thought leader was actually one of the other terms that I was considering, something like, you know, the thought leader marketing or the visible thought leader or something like that. But I decided to go with The Recognized Authority, but I always knew that I do want to use the word thought leader in something at some point. And I think that there's a real, this juxtaposition of thought leadership and AI, I think is a nice conflict that maybe will be provocative. And in fact, I had some people say that it was provocative when I asked them for feedback. They said, oh, that seems a bit provocative, which is exactly what I'm going for.
Yeah. Especially like if you've grown up in big firm consulting like I did, you know, thought leadership was this like lofty territory of only the geniuses. And then you say, AI, what? It's a really interesting juxtaposition. So it'll be fun to see where you take it. But I know anybody listening to this that has a podcast or is thinking about it, I know they want to know, how do you get the work done? Whether this is 5 podcasts or 7 podcasts or 4 podcasts, I'm going to assume you have a killer production process. You know, we listen to that. But I mean, how do you do it? Is it just that you have this agency you send everything to in addition to your assistant?
Oh, no, not at all.
But it still feels like it's a lot of work for you.
No, I don't have any. There's no external agency or anything. I think that I have just very good workflows. I think I'm a bit like Jonathan in this way. If there's something that I'm procrastinating on, I just remove it completely. Mm. So I was procrastinating on editing. So I just decided to get rid of editing by just recording the episodes live. So now I do like, I did an interview today, for example, with Debbie Jenkins. So that interview was from 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. today. And the episode was live on the podcast feed in audio format by about 5:15. And that was just because of just simple workflow and production line. I use AI. For example, I will when I take the audio and I process it, I use a tool called Ophonic. And what it does is it helps to balance and level the audio. It takes out noise if it detects noise. But it also, if you hook it up right, you can get it to do the transcription automatically. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I use a tool called Otter for transcription, but I like doing it all in one go. And then I was able to take the transcript of that and I feed that into Claude, which is an AI tool, a bit like ChatGPT, except it has a larger limit of input. And I say, hey, Claude, here is my podcast transcript. Can you take this and can you give me 5 title suggestions for this? And can you write the show notes according to this format for me, please? And then Claude gives me that back and I can just copy paste that in. So if you've got your workflow nailed down for that stuff, it's actually fairly easy to do that quickly. You need to have the philosophy, I think, of moving fast. This is where I think people coming from corporate, they move at a little bit of a slower pace than people who are more independent, have been independent for a long time. So I think that, you know, it's just about getting in the mindset, okay, we can get this done and out the door and live if we're okay with doing it quickly and using these tools and making our workflow so we don't have any edit step whatsoever.
Yes, speed, speed, speed. And I think part of that is that I think we think if we go too fast, we're going to make mistakes. And guess what? We will. Even if we go slow, we're going to make mistakes. If we go faster, we can make them faster.
Yeah.
And get to the other side faster.
Making the mistakes faster means that you get feedback on those mistakes faster, which means that you can adjust. And I think that that is something that is important because when you do things slowly, you adjust slowly to, you know, you don't have as much data. You don't have as much feedback because you're moving slowly on it. Yeah, I think that makes a difference.
So Alistair, I want to go someplace. I usually start with this question when I'm talking to soloists, but you know, once I realized you had all these podcasts, I had to go there first. But how did you start your business? I mean, what made you take the leap initially?
I don't think
I know this story.
Well, it's fairly simple. So I was a software engineer for many, many years. And so I worked on some really low level stuff. So some stuff like I did machine code for IBM mainframes. So really nerdy, like literally ones and zeros at some points. And then I was working in a company called Sun Microsystems, now part of Oracle. And I worked there for 6 or 7 years. And I was working on the operating system Solaris and a few different things in different places in that group. But what I realized was that I make for a terrible corporate employee. Just not a good fit here. And so I had and this is a very stereotypical Irish story. I was having a whiskey late one night with my mum, standing beside the fire, having a chat. And I said, I'm thinking about quitting, but I don't know what I'll do. And she said, well, what's the worst thing? If you quit and you try your own thing, what's the worst thing that can happen? And I said, well, I'll probably have to go and find a job. And she said, yeah, if that's the worst thing that can happen, you know, just take the leap. So I gave my notice the next day. And yeah, that was, I decided to start my own business. And I had very little transferable skill set because it's very hard to go from being a low-level software engineer into providing services for businesses at a kind of a higher level. The one thing I was good at was I had been a software engineer. I was good at making things like websites and coding and things like that. So I got into search engine optimization and I became a search engine optimization specialist. And then a lot of people kept asking me to build them websites. And so I started building websites again. That became Website Doctor, which was the agency, the kind of the full services generalist web agency, which had the specialization problem. So that's kind of full circle on that.
So how long did it take you to hit your first $100,000 a year?
Oh, well, this is funny. I actually got very, very lucky in that very first year.
Awesome.
And I got it in my first year. I built an e-learning platform for the International Federation of the Red Cross based out of Geneva. And I was just lucky because it was a chance conversation. You know how these things happen. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long time actually afterwards to get back up to that level. But I was very lucky that contract, I think, was, you know, it was well in the six figures. So, but it was a very complex system. And the software engineering background really helped with that. But it was kind of cool because back at the time, the e-learning platforms were not as developed as they are now. So we had to create everything from scratch. So I basically built a remote team to do that. So that gave me a lot of experience working with subcontractors and all of that as well.
You know, it's funny. I can't tell you how many people have told me it's like they'll hit 100,000 in that first year. And then the second year is like, and then they figure it out. You know, it just takes a while of having a great client in year one and then figuring out how to start building for the rest so they come more naturally. So I'm curious now, I mean, knowing what you do now about podcasting, would you have done it sooner or differently?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would have started sooner if I had a niche down earlier. And so I went broad because I think that was what the market, when I started my business, it was 2007. And I thought, wow, this is a great time to start a business. You know, the economy's great. You know, the sun is shining. And then boom, those next few years, particularly in Ireland, we had a really, like, our economy was very tied into the property boom here. And we went through this process of, it was darker in Ireland, economically speaking, than other places for a lot longer. So we only kind of climbed out of that in 2014 or 2015. Mm-hmm. So there was a few years, very lean years there. And so I think that's where I went more into that generalist kind of scramble mode where you do anything and everything, you know, just to keep afloat.
Yeah, you keep the lights on. I hear you. But I hope you bought your mom a really lovely bouquet of flowers and maybe a house.
Working on the second one.
So, Alistair, I do love to ask everybody this question. So if you could go back to who you were when you started your business in 2007, what's the one thing you'd advise him to do?
Buy lots of Bitcoin.
Anything else?
To give you a real answer is probably to look at niching down. This thing of niching down and specializing is a lot more important than you realize. I can't emphasize that enough. So yeah, that's probably it. Like, now I had very little business acumen. I mean, I was coming from a software engineering background. I was very lucky. I joined a mastermind very early on, and that helped me a huge amount. But not understanding the value of the niche, that was something that I wish that I understood earlier.
Awesome. Awesome. So we'll be putting all sorts of links to you and your content, including your podcast, in the show notes. But where's the best place for people to learn more about you?
Go to LinkedIn, search me on LinkedIn, and follow me on there. Send me a message, say hello.
And it's two T's, McDermott with two T's.
McDermott with two T's, yeah.
Yes. So, Alistair, thank you. I just so appreciate your sharing your podcasting journey and how you made the business work. And just some of this advice is just going to be pure gold for people trying to decide what to do with their podcast. So thank you.
Awesome. And my biggest advice is don't screw it up by not starting. You've got to start at some point. So, and if it's not podcasting, you know, it could be writing, it could be blogging, it could be a YouTube channel. Whatever, but do something and start building a personal brand. I think that's crucial for all of us who are experts and want to put ourselves out there, you know?
Perfect. So that's it for this episode. I hope you'll join us next time for The Soloist Life. Bye-bye.